Welcome to a bonus edition of the Issue Is podcast. This week, we had a chance to sit down with George Gascon, the LA County District Attorney, who is beloved by some folks on the progressive left and hated by some folks on the right. He is a big believer of criminal justice reform. He is sincere in his beliefs, but they are beliefs that a lot of folks don't like, including most of the folks in his office. Prosecutors overwhelmingly tried to recall him. The recall did not make it to the ballot, barely. He's facing a very tough reelection race. A bunch of folks, including a bunch of folks in his own office, are running against him. It's very rare that he does in-depth interviews. It has been over a year since we've talked to him. But this week we got a chance to sit down with him for a half hour. And I think this conversation gives you a good sense of what he believes in, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. It comes on a week where LA County adopted essentially a zero cash bail policy for everything except the most serious cases. It's a little complicated. It was not entirely his policy, although he embraces the concept. It was something that a judge forced through. But you'll hear him explain what the policy is, what he thinks about the policy, and sort of his worldview about criminal justice and what he thinks people don't get right about him. So here is our full, unedited conversation with the LA County District Attorney, George Gascon.
Mr. District Attorney, great to see you.
Good to see you.
So first up, can you explain what this change is when it comes to bail policy in sort of layman's terms?
Yeah, you know, so in California, we have 58 counties, and each county court, superior court, gets to set the structure for bail and release every year. The LA County Court this year decided to go into a system that is slightly different than what it has been traditionally. And what does it mean? It means that you have, basically, there is a three-tier system that they have created. Some of this was already in place before, by the way. It's important to understand that according to the penal code, there are many offenses where officers get to cite and release, meaning it's like a traffic citation, but it's for a misdemeanor offense. There are some where the officer gets to book and release, means they take the person to the station, they take a booking photograph, they do the official booking process, and then they release the person. And each of the instances, the person is cited back to come to court at a certain day. And then there is what they're calling a magistrate review on release. So this is where you get arrested, you go in front of a magistrate determines whether you're going to be released or whether there's going to be set some other conditions to your release. All this, by the way, occurs before a prosecutor ever sees the case. So what happens is you get arrested, you either get cited on release, or you get booked on release, or you go to a magistrate. This happens usually within 48 hours of the time that you got arrested, 72 if it's a weekend, if you're being held. If you got cited on release, of course, you're gone until your day comes back. What occurs is you get released. If you're not being held in custody, if you're held in custody, then you get arraigned, and then a prosecutor comes into the picture. And then we review your case, and there could be a second, sort of a second instance where there's going to be conditions of release set, which could include monetary bail. In California, the Supreme Court, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, under the Humphrey decision, ruled that you cannot hold a person for their inability to pay monetary bail, cash bail, beyond their capacity to pay for any non-serious or non-violent crime. So meaning that if all you can afford is $10, then that should be the bail. And that has been the law for some time now. Recently, a judge in Superior Court also ruled that cash bail is unconstitutional. By the way, there are many jurisdictions around the country that have gotten rid of cash bail, and they're functioning just fine. What has caused a little bit of a problem here is, you know, we in government are not very good at explaining things, and this is a very complicated process. The reality is that how much money you have in your bank account should not determine whether you're going to get released or not. In fact, we had an example here during COVID. We had a gentleman that kept posting bail. He posted about $500,000 collectively four different times for follow-home robberies. On the fifth time, he actually murdered someone. I've argued multiple times that we should be able to hold people back if we believe that they're a danger to our community, regardless of how much money you have. But the current system basically now has, you have a cite and release, or you have a book and release, or you have a magistrate review. All this happens before a prosecutor gets to see the person. If the prosecutor comes in at arraignment, then we can argue whether the person should be released, and that would be the question. You look at monetary bail, you look at uncle monitoring, you could be looking at other types, you know, like a regular call, you know, where you have the department of, you know, the reentry department, mm-hmm. they can call the individual, make sure they're going to show up for court. This is a process that has been in place for a long time. It just simply is being codified.
Do you think that cash bail is unconstitutional?
You know, I believe that how much money you have in your bank account should not determine whether you're going to get out or not. I have many examples of people that have posted cash bail, and they have gone out to hurt other people. I've also seen people that have been released without cash bail and have gone out to commit other crimes. I strongly believe that if you have an open case, you should not be released. If we determine that you're a danger to our community, you should not be released. It doesn't matter how much money you have. On the other hand, if it doesn't appear that you're a danger to our community, you don't have other open cases, we have a whole structure that's being built around releasing a person and allowing the person to show up for court when they're being cited. It's also important to understand jail capacity, right? Mm-hmm. Our jail is overcrowded. We are currently releasing people that should not be released sometimes, just simply because we don't have the space. If you get convicted of a crime in the county, you're doing only a portion of the time of your conviction because there is not enough space for the people that are coming in. About 40% of the people that are in our jail have mental health problems, and frankly, keeping them in jail for a few days does not alleviate their problem. We need to have other avenues to deal with this.
So is that a yes? Do you think that
cash bail is unconstitutional? I personally believe that cash bail is unconstitutional, and I tell you why. The Constitution says that we are innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
You're not proven guilty until the time is you either plead to some offenses, you plead to him, and you accept the plea deal, or you get convicted by a jury and sentenced. But what we have with cash bail is we have a system where people may be held back for months, you know, sometimes multiple months, waiting to have their day in court, and sometimes only to go out and be released, be proven not to have committed the crime or committed something other than what they were being booked for. I personally believe that cash bail is something that was created, you know, over 100 years ago. I think the utility of that process is no longer there. And again, there are many jurisdictions that have been doing without cash bail for many years, and they're working just fine.
Are you concerned that this change in policy could make people less safe?
I am concerned that when we have people that have open cases under the current court policy, that is not a factor that would automatically hold you back during the pre-arraignment process. Again, I want to make it very clear. Once we get into an arraignment, then we have a prosecutor, and we can argue those things. The problem is that people actually go through this interim process before a prosecutor ever gets to see the case. I'm very concerned that if you have an open case, let's say that you were involved in a smash and grab, right, or you were involved in car theft, or any other offense, and you are released, and then you go out and you reoffend before you even have your next day in court, I don't believe that you should be released again.
So what can you do?
But not because of cash bail. You should have just released.
So then should there be a different process, like a 24-hour arraignment court or some sort of system where the state is talking to each other about who's being cited? I mean, should there be specific changes to avoid that situation?
Yeah, I personally think, look, there are places like the state of New York that has, you know, courts that are working 7 days a week, you know, around the clock. I believe that we should have that. I believe that it should be, rather than citing and releasing people, you should be able to get in front of a magistrate immediately. You should have the defense and the prosecutor, and you argue the merits of the case, and you either get released or you get detained. I absolutely believe that that should be the case. Now, that's not where we are today.
Right.
The court is trying to get somewhere there by providing a magistrate 7 days a week available to review those cases where they have said that requires magistrate review. So again, you got the three tiers: cite release.
Sure.
You get cited and released in the, you know, the streets, basically. You have book and release. You go to the station, you get booked, you get your photo taken, you get released, and then you have magistrate release. And in those cases, the police has to present the case to a magistrate. There will be around 7 days a week, and they will make a determination whether the person is going to be released or there are some other conditions that are going to be placed, including pretrial detention.
Do you think that there should be either a countywide or even a statewide process where law enforcement can talk to each other and know if somebody has just been cited within the last 24 hours so they're not released?
I think that is absolutely the case. And, you know, if you're book and release, that already exists, yeah. Right? Because the system, as soon as you get booked, that generates a system-wide notification this person was booked for a particular crime. When you're cited and released, because it's more like a citation, it takes a while for the system to cash out. I absolutely believe that there should be a system that accounts for that. That is not the case today. Now, we should also know that on the cite and release part of it, you're really talking about very, very minor offenses. Driving without a license, you know, you're talking about low-level misdemeanors, driving suspended driver's license. So that's the type of offense you're talking mostly on the cite and release, very low-level theft. But should it be a system there that we can see immediately? Absolutely.
Because you know there's people that are see the images of the smash and grabs, and they're afraid that the people will get cited, released, and go do it again somewhere
okay.
else.
And I'm so glad that you brought this, Alec, because smash and grab do not fall in this category, right? Smash and grabs are violent crimes. They're generally going to be robberies. We're charging conspiracy for those cases. So those cases are going to go through a magistrate review. And, you know, they're going to have other conditions or they're going to be detained, you know, and in the current system, there will be monetary bail set for them. So it's important that we know that when we're talking about the smash and grab or organized retail theft, those are by and large violent crimes. They will be outside of this rubric.
What about the people that go into a store, take stuff out of it, maybe it's under $950? Mm-hmm. There's people that feel like there's like no consequence for that right now. What do you say
well,
to that?
Well, there are. It's just a question of if we collectively do our work. Number one, anything under $950 is a misdemeanor. So you can still go to, you can still be sentenced and go to jail for 6 months or have to pay $1,000. Number one. Number two, if you commit multiple thefts of under $950 that are all in concert, meaning that they are the same people, the same way of operating within close proximity to time, meaning, you know, within a day or two, we can aggregate those things and actually create a whole different structure, right? The problem is that often that is not being done, right? We're just throwing our arms up and saying, well, it's under 950, it's a misdemeanor, it's cite and release. Well, it depends, right? If we have multiple incidents of this, actually the penal code allows for aggregation of this, and then it gets treated differently.
How is this policy change that's happening now different from what you wanted to do on day one in terms of changing bail requirements?
Well, I think in many ways it's very similar, right? I personally do not believe in cash bail for the same reasons that I mentioned earlier. I just don't believe that how much money you have in your bank account determines whether you're dangerous or not. And we get, you know, examples of that every time. As a gentleman that I mentioned to you, collectively, he posted about $500,000, which meant that he had a $5 million bail collectively, mm-hmm. because, you know, you only post about 10% of your bail if you go through a bail bondsman, and then he went out and committed murder, mm-hmm. and he should have been held back. So I don't believe that cash should be the determining factor. I believe that if you're dangerous to our community, and we as prosecutors can prove that with the evidence provided by the police, we should argue that you should be detained regardless of how much money you have. Conversely, if you're not dangerous and you don't have an open case and you have, you know, you pledge to come back, and most people do, by the way, come back and face their day in court, I think you should be released.
We know that there are 12 different cities in LA County that are working to try to stop this change.
Yeah.
Do you agree with them?
I don't. I think that what we need to do is we need to come together. We need to make sure that the court, especially in the magistrate release part of it, there are crimes that we believe that should be move away from, you know, from the pre-magistrate review. So for instance, if you have an open case, I don't think, regardless of what the offense is, I don't think you get cited and released. I think a magistrate should look at it, look at the circumstances and come up with a different outcome. I think that if you are involved in a residential burglary, which right now is being deemed as one of those book and release, I believe that a residential burglary is a violent crime, and I believe that you should be held back, and you should have a magistrate review. And again, your dangerousness should be assessed, and if you should be detained in pretrial confinement, then you should be. So I believe that there are things that need to occur. I am very hopeful that those things will occur. I think that fighting this and saying we want to get rid of it altogether and go back to the way the system was before, it flies in the face of reality that the old system wasn't working. Look, under the current system before this order by the court, in L.A. County and for many years now, if you had a bail of under $50,000, you were being released immediately because there's no jail space, right? If you're convicted of a crime where you're doing your time in a county jail, you're doing about 10% of your time as opposed to doing most of your time. What we have to understand is that when we hold people back that are not dangerous, we're occupying space that did not allow us to hold people that are dangerous. So do we need to continue to work with the courts to make sure people that have open cases, people that are committing residential burglaries are going to be held back? 100%. And, we had a representative, my representative at the board here the other day said as much. I said, we need to make sure those people are held back. But just simply to go back to the old way, I just don't see it.
Yolo County studied this, and in their study, they found that it made their area less safe, and that crime went up.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've read that study.
I read, but here's where it gets dangerous, when people represent a simple counting of numbers as a study, right? Yolo County was not a study. There was no control group. There was no understanding of what they were, what were they counting? Crime went up in the entire nation during COVID, mm-hmm. right? Not just California, not just Yolo County. It went up everywhere. Mm-hmm. It went up in LA County. It went up in our surrounding counties. But what Yolo County did is not necessarily what I would consider a study. They just took a bunch of numbers, they added them up and said, okay, these people, and by the way, when I said this, we questioned even the methodology of that counting, because it was very result-oriented. Did not show up for court as they had agreed without looking at, were they already arrested and booked for something else? Did they die? Was there some other intervening factors? There are many studies that have been done in not only in LA County, but around the nation about, doing away with cash bail, where actually the numbers indicate that the returning people coming back to face a day in court is actually higher than when you have cash bail.
So big picture, for people that are concerned that this is going to make LA County less safe, and people are going to be held less accountable, what say you?
What I say is that there are things that need to be improved. We're going to work on them. I don't believe that long-term this is going to make the county less safe. I think it's going to make us safer because it's going to create more room in our county jail to hold the people that are dangerous, which often we're releasing because we don't have the space. It is a work in progress. There will be things that are going to need to be amended. I'm very aggressive about making those things. For instance, again, people that have open cases, I want to make sure that they face a different level of review. People that commit residential burglaries. But I think that by and large, the majority of the people that get arrested, they're going to get released within a few days. What we have to understand is there is a finality to the utility of pretrial detention. And we just have to make sure that we reserve that for the people that are dangerous, the people that are reoffending, or the people that are not going to show up, and the rest of the people, we should let them come back and see the day in court.
A couple other questions while I have you.
Yeah, please.
Ryan Klinkenbrumer, the LA County Sheriff's deputy that was killed, you are not going forward with the death penalty in his case. You don't go forward with the death penalty in any cases. Neither does the governor, by the way, doesn't allow the death penalty to even happen in California.
Half of the states in the union now do not have the death penalty, right? So it's
But you heard, I'm sure, from his family and that they were very frustrated by that. What's your message to his family?
Look, I mean, first of all, and I have said this time and time again, I'll say again, I feel horrible for the death, right? I was in policing for many years. I have attended way too many law enforcement officers' funerals. The pain that the family is going through is immeasurable, right? We are seeking life without the possibility of parole, which is a very, very serious penalty, assuming, by the way, that he's found guilty. The problem with the death penalty is the death penalty doesn't work, right? The death penalty, to begin with, has very little finality. You're looking at a process where you have decades of appeal, where the family will be put through this roller coaster, going to court over and over again. You're looking at a process where about 50% of the people that actually do get a death sentence end up being removed from death sentence because there were other problems, mental health. There are many other components that would not allow the death penalty to occur. You're looking at a system that is irreversible. If we actually execute someone and we made a wrongful conviction, you cannot fix that. And we have seen wrongful convictions. And by the way, this is not something, you know, I heard somebody say, well, that only happened years ago when the technology wasn't there. No, it happens today. We've had cases after DNA that we've seen wrongful convictions. I think that there are just too many things about the death penalty that are wrong. And I think that what we need to do is we need to understand that if this individual is found guilty, he will face life without the possibility of parole. He will die in prison. There is nothing that is going to bring Ryan back. Mm-hmm. And the pain that the family is going through is incomprehensible to most of us, right? And I feel extremely, extremely sorry because this is a crime that should never have occurred. As, you know, all murders, by the way, but this was one, you know, Ryan, by all accounts, was a model deputy. I heard the sheriff says, you know, he became a training officer with really not too many years on the job. He was respected in the community. He was respected in the department. He was brutally murdered. Mm-hmm. And this individual will face the consequences of that, and we're going to work really hard to make sure that that occurs.
You're running for re-election.
I am.
A lot of people in your office are running against you.
Yeah.
Why do you think so many people that work for you are running against you?
Well, you know, we looked at the first time that Cooley ran for re-election, there were six people running against him, right? Yeah. So it seems to run in the space, right? Jackie Lacey had a couple of people running against her. You know, this is a large office. There's a lot that comes with being the district attorney of LA. And I think also you can add to it that in addition to the past, and by the way, like I said, you know, Cooley ran against Garcetti. And threw him out of office, people forget that. Is that, you know.
Gil Garcetti, for people that may not know.
Yeah, that's right.
Gil Garcetti, yeah.
No, you're absolutely right.
Gil Garcetti, some people might know.
Father Garcetti, right? Absolutely. I think that, you know, the system is going through an evolution. And any time that you're going through an evolution is very hard for people that have been in it for a long time. And I understand why some people are disagreeing with some of the policies and they want to go in a different direction. And I also understand why some people just, they want to be the DA. I totally get it. They have been in the office for 20, 30 years. They feel that is their time. And you know, the beauty of a democracy is that we get to do these things. You know, and the public gets to evaluate difference in policies, difference in approach to the work, and then they can make a decision.
Who do you think is the toughest competition?
You know, it's too early to tell. You know, I feel very strongly about it. I'm going to work really hard to earn the, you know, every single vote, and hopefully I'll be in office again. I'll be honored by the position, but it's too early to tell at this point.
And just thinking about the office so far, what are you sort of most proudest of, and what do you maybe think, I learned that lesson, things should change on that?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm most proud of the fact that when I came into office, you know, crime was going up everywhere, in the country, the county. But here, immediately, those that were against me started to say, well, it's because of the policies. And now we have seen so crime this year started to go back. We're getting close to pre-pandemic numbers. In fact, we're definitely, when it comes to violence, we're in the 10-year average now. We haven't reached 2019, but we're in the 10-year average because 2019 was a really very different year. No one knows why. And we see that all the policies have been implemented and crime is going down, which tells me, and hopefully we'll tell others as you review this, that the policies were not causing the crime to increase. We knew that, but now there is proof of that. So I'm very proud of that. What are the things that I would look back and say, geez, I wish I would have done a little differently? Look, when I came into office, we had about 10% of our workforce showing up, right? Mm-hmm. People were working remotely. Every communication was done digitally. It was before we had a vaccine. We were all running scared. I visited every single branch and office in this organization, and it was not uncharacteristic for me to, you know, visit a place where there were 30 employees and there would be one or two. I wish if there would have been a capacity to have more of the ability to meet people in person, to have conversations with people in person. But that's not what occurred, and, you know, it is what it is.
Most of those deputy DAs ran against you, so they never even talked to you.
Well, I mean, you have to also, I mean, for the public, need to understand that this is an office of 2,200 people.
Yeah.
Actually, some of them I've talked to, but, you know, I mean, it's just like when I went through, now I've made visits, now people say, you know, I've been in the office 30 years, this is the first time that I see the DA coming and talking to us, right? And that's not a slight on my predecessor. It's the reality. You have an office in the largest county in the country. You know, if we were state, we would be the eighth largest state. You know, we have over 10 million people. It is impossible for anyone to see every one of the employees. So there's no question there may be some that have never met me, just like some had never met the prior DAs.
Sure. If you had to real succinctly state the case for your reelection, what is it?
I think, you know, we are showing that the reforms that we put in place are working. Crime is coming down. It will continue to go down. We're working with all the other partners to make sure that we get to a 21st century type of approach to our work, where we are able to deal with mental health appropriately, where we hold people accountable that need to be held accountable, and people that need to be given a second chance are given an opportunity. And what we're doing is showing that that can be done.
And LA is safer with you in charge?
I think LA is safer today than it has been in a very long time, and I believe that it will be even more so as time goes on.
And lastly, you know, there's a lot said about you. Some of it is true, some of it is not.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest misconception out there about you?
I think that the biggest misconception about me is that I don't care about public safety. You know, I think people don't know, most people do not know, I was in policing for 3 decades. I've spent most of my adult life thinking about the safety of our community. I care deeply about the safety of our community, and I think that people often, because of what they hear, they say, well, he doesn't care about us, he doesn't care about the safety, and that's so far from the truth. It's so disconnected with what I am, what I do, what I believe.
Why do you think that perception exists?
Look, politics are brutal, right? You know, and people, in order to make a point, they have to create a certain view of what it is. I think that you hear, you know, I have been blamed for releases of people that I had nothing to do with, that were just, you know, they finished their time in prison, that were released. I have been blamed for the way the office charges a case in cases that actually had nothing to do with my policies, or that I was not even, you know, we handle about 130,000 cases a year. I think there are some people that believe that I'm personally touching every case. Clearly I'm not. So I think that what you had is a combination of things. That we had COVID, there was a tremendous amount of this, you know, dislocation.
Sure.
Community-wide. I think people are angry. There's so many other things going on. You know, the economy has gone in 100 different directions. I think all of this is coming together, and then you have social media where, you know, unfortunately, you know, it used to be the time where it was you guys, you know, that, and when I say you guys, you, professional journalists,
sure,
the ones that communicated with the public, and you know, there were certain ethical standards to the way you put out information.
Fact-checking, too.
Fact-checking, right? Now, anybody that has access to the internet can put anything that they want to do. They become
often anonymously.
Anonymously, correct,
right.
or given, you know, some other other identity. Which makes your job, by the way, really difficult. I mean,
right.
I would not want your job today, because it's so hard. You're competing with this world. I think that there's just so much misinformation out there, and it's coming from everywhere. It's coming from the right, from the left, from every direction. And I think that the people are running around angry. They're scared, and sometimes their fear is well-based. You know, if crime is happening in your neighborhood,
sure,
you know, you should be scared. But I think so much of it, too, is just, you know, you see, like, you know, you take a smash and grab, right? And it's a horrible event, it's violent, people should be held accountable. But the same event will be played over multiple times, not only by the traditional media, but also then it goes in social media, right?
Sure.
I tell people, when I was a young officer in Hollywood Division, there was a time there where there were people that were doing takeover robberies of restaurants, where they would prone everybody out. They basically went through the women's purse, they took every piece of property that they could, horrendous acts, right? There were no cameras. There was no social media. You know, this was covered maybe in the 6 o'clock and the 10:30 or 11 o'clock news, and that was the end of it. Restaurant owners, especially higher-end restaurants in the west side of Hollywood and all that stuff, were running scared. They were hiring off-duty cops. And we talk about it. I said, you know, could you imagine if that were to happen today? One of those things will be played up thousands of times, if not more. So I think that we have a different world, and we all need to learn how to navigate that world, and that's part of my work.
Well, and part of that also is having conversations like this, so we appreciate you giving 100%. Us time and hope to do this more often as
Love
well and hear your perspective, because there is so much misinformation,
yeah.
And so to hear it from the horse's mouth is the way to get the stories correct. George Gascon, thanks for having
us here. I appreciate it.
Good to
Thank
see you
so much for stepping by. Appreciate it.
Our thanks to George Gascon, and we hope we will have more conversations with him soon. If you want to listen to the regular version of the Issue Is podcast for this week, a conversation with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker Emerita, plus Young Kim, the Republican Congresswoman, on a week where the Republican Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, was ousted from Congress. A lot to talk about with both of them. In the meantime, thank you for listening to this episode of The Issue Is. We'll see you next week for more. I hope you like and subscribe, and reach out to us in social media. Love hearing from folks. Thanks so much.